You've got a president who's really set out to see if you can do it in America in 1973 the way they did it in Germany in 1933, and has decided that he's got to innovate a little bit, but basically is headed the same place.
On March 9, 1973, Commissioner Nicholas Johnson of the Federal Communications Commission addressed the annual convention of the Speech Association of the Eastern States here in New York City. Mr. Johnson spoke on the intimidation of the nation's broadcast media by the Nixon administration, as introduced by Howard Schwartz, president of the SAES.
In introducing our speaker this morning, let me first give you a very, very brief chronology. He was born 39 years ago to great friends and contributors to the speech field, Dr. and Mrs. Wendell Johnson. He's a Phi Beta Kappa at the University of Texas in 1956. After graduating from Texas Law School in 58, he served as law clerk to Judge John R. Brown, now Chief Justice of the Fifth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. And from 59 to 60, he was a clerk for Justice Hugo Black of the Supreme Court. From 1960 to 1963, he was a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. And in 1964, at the ripe age of 29, he was appointed by President Johnson, who was no relation, as maritime administrator. In 1966, at the riper age of 32, he was appointed one of the seven commissioners of the Federal Communications Commission, a position which expires July 1st of this year, so he will be unemployed, and those of you who wish to interview him, he'll be available after this session. What I've rattled off is most impressive in terms of his own credentials, but it does not say some of the things which I'd like you to know about our speaker. So I'd like to introduce a man who bicycles to work, a man who bakes his own bread, a man who composes his songs, whom John Kenneth Galbraith has called the least frightened man in Washington, the man who received the New Republic's Public Defender Award, the man whose forthright positions had five state broadcasting associations clamoring for his impeachment, the author of two books, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set, and Test Pattern for Living, his latest book. They are both featured in the exhibition hall today, and numerous articles. As a member of the FCC, he has continually been the voice of dissent. It's a very, very great pleasure for me to present to you this morning the Honorable Nicholas Johnson, Commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission.
Thank you very much, Howard. The only thing you really left out there, and what I'm sure resulted in telling these people much more than they cared to know about me, is that the great contribution made by my speech teachers in high school, who I would say are really responsible for where I am today, if for no other reason than you invited me here recently. You know, it's really a very nerve-wracking thing to contemplate the prospect of making a speech to a group of people who really know how you're supposed to do it. I've never really understood that myself. Fortunately, I don't think I was graded on speeches. I made it through without that, but with some of their guidance. So I'm going to try to forget about that I've got to make you all speech, and just tell you a little something about the FCC and what's been going on these last few years while I've been there, and what implications I think that may have for some things I think you might be doing in speech courses and with your students and so forth, as well as perhaps some comments along the way about what the president's up to these days and so forth. Let me start by suggesting that I think you can be the ones to help carry the message to the university community generally that the concept of communications is a useful perspective, I think, to bring to bear on virtually any set of subject matter. We tend to split it up, and even within the speech departments among speech teachers, and we've got debate, and we've got dramatics, and public speaking, and then some people in speech pathology, I suppose, and so forth. And I would like to suggest that it's much broader than that. There's something very distinctively human about our capacity to create and manipulate symbols. As my father once wrote, man is the only animal who is able to talk himself into difficulties that would not otherwise exist. And by the same token, hopefully, we can talk ourselves out of some of them if we learn how to do it. The process of attaining humanness, individuality, self-fulfillment is in large measure tied to our ability to formulate individual ideas and perspectives of our own and to express them, to create and use our own symbols. And I think sometimes at the FCC, when we're voting on the height of antenna towers or overlapping signals or whatnot, we sometimes tend to slight a little bit the really crucial quality and human quality of what it is we're supposed to be doing. And just as the health of the individual is in large measure a function of his understanding of the role of the symbolic process, his own capacity to express himself, so is the health of our society a function of the extent to which our communication systems are working well. And this is supposed to be the FCC's job, as some of you may know. And as you may also know, I don't think it's doing that job very well. You know that we have some responsibility for radio and television, and what that is, I want to talk about a little later. But at this point, note that we also have responsibilities for regulating the telephone company, to the extent anyone can regulate a corporation that is larger than virtually every nation in the world. Communication satellites, domestic and international, cable television, which though related to broadcasting is really a new animal altogether, land mobile radio, taxi cabs, police cars, citizen band radio, so-called, anybody who wants to have this device. International cables, cables under, now I can see you. I knew there was someone out there. I thought if I started off that way, they'd turn those off pretty soon. Well, now I want to get down and really tell you something. Now back to radio and television. Now, it is important to recognize that all these things are related and make it possible for the society to function. That when the telephone breaks down in Wall Street, it's not just that somebody lost his dime in the box, it's that somebody failed to execute a multi-thousand or $100,000 stock transaction. That is the ramification out there in the real world. That the fact that we charge more to call from Alaska and Hawaii to Washington, D.C. than we charge to call from Maryland or Virginia to Washington, D.C. affects the political process, the ability of the citizens in those states to communicate with Washington. And when you recognize that one half of the cost of a long distance call is the cost of billing you for that call, and when you recognize that the costs are really distance insensitive, I mean, if there's a satellite up there, it's 22,000 miles up and 22,000 miles back down, and it doesn't make much difference how far apart those ground stations are, you begin to get a sense of what the extent to which these policies do have social and political implications, that they're not just technical things worked out by engineers and lawyers, and that the FCC is largely totally oblivious to the impact of what it's doing or is diabolically committed to a path that it knows is not serving the public interest. Let us give them the benefit of the doubt and assume they don't know what they're doing. Now, I would like to encourage you all, to those of you who are not already doing it, to teach more in regular speech courses about the public policy aspects of communications, because I think that's just terribly important for reasons that I'll go on to talk about. Let me say at this point something about our regulation of radio and TV and the presumptions under which we do it in this country. Because Congress originally considered a variety of ways of setting up this system originally, that we would have public ownership, as the British chose to do, public corporation, that we would let every special interest group in the country have its own outlet, that we would have very low power systems, so that you could have little neighborhood transmitters and whatnot, or that we would have superpower transmitters, and you'd have only three or four radio stations that would cover the whole country, and so forth. All these possibilities were considered. What we ended up doing was establishing a system of public trustees, private individuals permitted to make private profit from the use of public property, and rather gargantuan private profit, as it has turned out, who would assume in return an obligation to serve the public interest. This is very much like somebody who goes into a national forest to cut timber or drill for oil or graze sheep or what have you. The use of the airwaves, Congress said, is the use of public property. And in the very first section of the Communications Act having to do with commercial broadcasting, they made very clear there shall be no right of property in that station. It is subject to the terms of a license, this use. And that when that license expires, the opportunity to continue functioning as a public trustee expires with it. And that license now expires every 3 years. And at that time, the broadcaster must come back to the FCC and say, I would like to do it for another, you know, 3 more years, as we now say. And at that time, the FCC must consider his record. He runs on his record, the same way a congressman does when he's up for re-election. Your broadcaster's up for re-election, and he's running on his record. And he's saying, here's what I did for my community. Here's why you should give me another 3 years to do it to him. Now, the other thing you need to know is that we made a decision that has resulted in our having now some 8,000 local radio and television stations. Now, why did we do that? We've taken 95% of the most valuable frequency space in the United States and given it to this purpose. This is frequency space, which, if you recall my earlier remarks, is also desired by users of land mobile radio as one example. Business interests, the Defense Department, taxi cabs, police departments, all those people need those same frequencies that your local radio and television stations are using. And we've made a national policy judgment that we are going to have a tremendous amount of congestion on land mobile radio frequencies, because it is so important that we have these 8,000 radio and television stations. Now, why? Well, because, the theory goes, they are providing a local service. A local service. To the extent a radio station is simply playing records that are distributed nationally, playing commercials that are distributed nationally, reading news off a wire that is distributed nationally, to the extent a television station is using network material, news, entertainment shows, nationally distributed movies, nationally distributed commercials, to that extent, it is not being used in accordance with a basic presumption under which we made this incredibly significant decision to allocate this most valuable frequency space to these 8,000 stations. Because that service, that distribution of national product, can be done by satellite to home broadcasting, can be done by cable television distribution systems, it can be done by superpower radio and television stations. You don't need 8,000 stations to do that job. So that is the reason why the emphasis on local service, and by local service I mean not just local news and public affairs, but local entertainment, local sports, the whole range of involving the local community in the running of that radio or television station. Why that is not just a frill. Why that is not something that you come and beg from your local radio and television station. That is something which you by right can demand from your local radio and television station, because that is the single underlying presumption for their very existence. And once they stop providing that service, by rights, you simply take station off the air. I mean, they're not performing any useful function in terms of the use of frequencies in the United States. The third thing you need to know is something about what your legal rights are as an individual with regard to these stations. The renewal process I've already mentioned. Every 3 years, all the stations in your state, whatever your state may be, all the radio and television stations in your state come up for renewal the same day. This is therefore an ideal project for you to involve yourself and your students in for purposes of comparative evaluation of these stations. Which stations in your city or your state do you think are doing the best job, and why? And see to it that they get some credit for it. Which stations in your city or state do you think are doing the worst job, and why? And see to it that they get proper attention. Now, you can participate in the license renewal process. You can file a pleading. You can be a party to that license renewal, a contest. And my own experience as a former law professor is that it is very useful for students to be involved in something that is, you know, that actually matters, that's really going on, where what they do is going to have an effect, an impact on public policy or a decision or something out there in the real world. There's a growing demand for that, I think. I detect on the students I talk to around the country. To be involved in something outside of the classroom, to see an impact of what they're doing. Well, here's an ideal project for that purpose, and something that affects the lives of all of them every day, the radio and television program to which they are exposed, and to which they are exposed, one might note, for far more hours than they are exposed to the teachings of either their professors or their parents or their ministers or anybody else. The second thing you can do involves rulemaking proceedings. Three women in Boston who were concerned because Captain Kangaroo was going to be canceled off their local station met and ultimately established something called Action for Children's Television, a national organization which it turned out was able to produce some 100,000 letters at the FCC in support of their rulemaking petition to eliminate advertising from children's television, on the grounds that whatever advertisers and broadcasters may think of adults, children are at least entitled to be treated as something other than simply little consumers. There are other proposals that you can make in the form of new rules. The FCC has, in effect, the kind of authority that Congress has to promulgate laws. We can promulgate rules and regulations that have the same effect as if they had been enacted as laws by the United States Congress. And the way in which you get that process started is by filing a proposed rulemaking. There's something you don't like, figure out a rule that would affect a change in it, and file it with the FCC and propose that we consider it in this way. As these women have done, hearings have been held, panel discussions have been held before the commission, and their proposals receiving very serious consideration. Whether it will be adopted or not is another issue, but the fact is that the mere consideration of it has itself had an impact. Number of commercials on children's programming has been cut from 16 to 12 per hour by the industry. Vitamin commercials have been deleted from that programming by the industry. And I think both of those are a direct result of the fact that the rulemaking petition was filed, you know, whether or not it's ultimately acted on, because they're frightened of it, just as the proposal by Congressman Pepper to introduce legislation banning drug advertising on television produced a recent industry voluntary agreement with regard to the way in which drugs will be advertised on television. A third is the fairness doctrine. Fairness doctrine requires two things. One, that a station must cover controversial issues of public importance. Did you know that? The fairness doctrine requires that stations in your community must cover controversial issues of public importance. The second thing the fairness doctrine requires is that when they do that, they have to be essentially, basically fair about the way in which they do it. And more or less than that, you can't really say without getting into a lot of details the way in which it's administered. But you can find out how it's administered by writing for a little primer on the fairness doctrine, which contains summaries of a lot of these decisions. They do not need to balance each program, although they think they do. And they use that as an excuse in talking to their producers and explain that that's why the producer can't say what he really believes, because they've got to, they don't have to balance it under the fairness doctrine within a given program. Their overall programming, somewhere in the overall programming, they have to see to it that all points of view get a fair shake. It may be in terms of editorials, it may be news coverage, it may be a special public affairs show, it may be an interview in the middle of a talk show. A lot of ways in which they can balance up their programming. And the FCC does not tell them what they have to say. It just says, it's, you know, see to it that you're not simply using your station as an instrument of propaganda. A newly evolving doctrine is the doctrine of access. This finds its principal legal basis in a Supreme Court decision called the Red Lion case, in which the fairness doctrine was being contested by the broadcasting industry as being unconstitutional. Let it be noted that they lost that preposterous argument unanimously. But in the course of finding the fairness doctrine not only constitutional, but very probably constitutionally compelled, the court said there is no right of private censorship in a medium not open to all. And what is being argued here, in effect, is that the First Amendment may have been adequately served in the 1700s and early 1800s by permitting you to go stand on a soapbox in your city park, or stand outside the church door on Sunday morning on the village green, or print up handbills and put them around on some trees. But that in the 1970s, that is simply no longer adequate. That if you as an individual and the organizations to which you belong as organizations are to have a meaningful impact on the dialogue of our times, that you simply must have access to the principal conduits of information flow in the United States, which are no longer soapboxes and handbills on trees, but are radio and television and newspapers. Although the newspaper issue has never been expressly addressed by the court, it did have a footnote in the Red Lion case with regard to newspapers. Some businessmen went to a station in Washington, D.C. and said they wanted to buy time to put on an anti-war message. They were turned down by the station. Said, we only sell time to sell products. Now, if you'd like to sell guns or weapons of war or something like that, we'd be happy to take your money. But if you want to say something like an idea, we're not in that business. So they wouldn't take their money. So they came to the FCC, because these were, you know, conservative businessmen, and they figured, well, you know, it must have been some fluke here, and money buys everything, we all know that, and somehow we don't understand what happened to the station, but of course the government will see our position and will, you know, give us redress. Well, they were instantly radicalized. As soon as they found out that the FCC, of course, conceives of its function as simply doing the industry's bidding, which it promptly did, and I just as promptly wrote a dissent, and the United States Court of Appeals just as promptly reversed the FCC and essentially upheld the dissent, which it had done in a number of cases. By and large, if you can ever find somebody to appeal, you can generally get an FCC decision reversed, because they're all wrong. But with a small staff, I can't dissent in all of them. And with more meager resources on the outside, there's nobody to appeal them all. In any event, these were businessmen, as I explained, and so they did appeal, and so they got it reversed. And now the industry has gone back to the court again, the Supreme Court, to argue that, the Republic is going to fall if we permit individuals to actually buy time for the discussion of ideas on radio and television. And it remains to be seen what the new court will do with that argument. Well, in any event, those are some of your legal rights that you ought to know. Now, what's wrong with the system as it's evolved is basically three things I'll say for this morning. One is the control of the system by commercial interests. A second is the control of the process by large institutions, including the super news concept, which I'll describe in a moment. And the third is what I will call presidential propaganda. The commercial control comes from the fact that television and radio are not really in the programming business, they're in the business. They watch their stock prices and they look at their profit and loss statements and they're like anybody else. It has nothing to do with programming. And the people who are in charge of it, by and large, all come up through the sales side. People who started off selling shoes or automobiles and worked their way up to selling commercials on radio stations and then worked their way up to become sales managers and then became general managers of radio and television stations. By and large, that's the career pattern. And those are the people who are in charge. They don't listen to their own stations or watch them. They do watch their balance sheets. They're very concerned about the number of commercials sold. And so programming kind of goes by default. Not only does it go by default, but it really has nothing to do with the enterprise. Many people think of programming as the product and the viewer as the consumer. Nothing could be further from the truth. The viewer is the product. The viewer is the product. The consumer is the advertiser. The broadcaster is selling viewers to advertisers. That is the television business. And the advertiser buys you from the broadcaster, like cattle, at a cost per thousand, in order that you will watch his advertising message. And the purpose of the stuff that comes in between the advertising messages is to hold you there for the commercial. And it builds to a peak, and you could write them by computer. And once you understand that, you get a little better perspective, I think, on why that filler is as bad as it is. Because it has nothing to do with the business that's being transacted. You are the one who's being sold to the advertiser, who is then left free to work his will on you and your three-year-old children, we might add. There is corporate censorship. It's one of the most severe forms of censorship, even in this age of presidential propaganda. I could go on and on with stories out of my own experience. Last time I was on the Merv Griffin show and some things I had to say about commercials there. At the end of the program, Merv turns to the audience and says, well, you know, these fellows, the other folks were Mort Saul and Peter Fonda and Michael Crichton were on that night with me. And Merv turns to the audience and says, well, you know, these folks have said some pretty controversial things, but by gollies, we got to give CBS a big hand for letting them say them. And then CBS got its big hand because those lights came on and said applause, and you know the audience always does what it's told, and so CBS got its big hand. And sure enough, when the show went out over the air, because that was videotaped, you know, there's no such, the television is dead, that's what they mean. I mean, there's no live television. Whenever television gets off into life, it gets lost. That's what Mason Williams said. Well, when the show was actually aired, CBS got its big hand there at the end, all right. I wondered a little bit why, you know. I mean, after all, the law says, as I just explained to you, that they have an obligation to deal with these issues. And, you know, none of us get applause at the end of the day for having done our job. You know, Nick put in a full day at the office today. Let's give him a big hand. But put that aside. Okay, CBS wants to give itself a big hand for this exceptional thing. It's like the entry in the log, you know, Captain reported sober today. CBS wants to give itself a big hand for doing its job. You know, that's okay. But what CBS was getting the big hand for never appeared on the air. It had been wiped clean off the videotape.
which made the applause a little hard to understand.
Now, that's not the first time that's happened to me, but the collection of my personal experiences with this problem are really pale by significance to the broader problem. David Rintels came and testified before Senator Irvin, I believe, on a whole string of examples of things that writers have tried to deal with in their filler material between the commercials that has been excised by either the sponsors or the networks. In this age of canceled dramas about Vietnam, one of the show we all will not see this evening, one of Rintel's examples some months ago before Senator Irvin was of a drama about Vietnam they wanted to do on the feelings of the soldier who was going into battle for the first time, which they thought would make a good story. These were the writers who wanted to write this. And they get the memo back from the executives who say, well, you know, it's a pretty good idea, but we'd just like to make a couple changes. Like, we thought maybe instead of setting it in Vietnam, we'd set it in Spain, and and instead of making it a war, we thought we'd make it a bullfight. What do you think about that? These things go on and on. I mean, the time Ford refused to sponsor a program that showed the Chrysler building in the New York City skyline. Procter & Gamble had a statement of editorial policy. We will not be associated with any program that says that in any way says anything disparaging about any American business enterprise. A lady I was on a show with once, I guess it was Steve Allen program, and during a break she told me an anecdote about it. She was some actress whose name you would know if I could remember, but I never can remember those people. But she was some famous actress, and she'd done this television program, this drama back when they used to have dramas on television, and the whole thing built, because she was supposed to be a rich lady, but really, she didn't have any money, see? And so this whole drama builds up, and she's dealing with this guy, and she says, you don't understand. I don't own a thing. Well, and upon the delivery of this line, out from behind the curtains rush this army of gorillas, the advertisers and the network executives, and everybody's out on the floor at once, and she just is, you know, she's, and the cameras have stopped. She goes, what's the matter? She says, it's in the script. It's what I'm supposed to. You can't say that. You can't say, well, why? I don't understand. You know, why can't I say that? I don't own a thing. Lady, we're trying to sell things to people. You go out there and say you don't own a thing. How can we sell things in a commercial? Well, she just didn't believe it. She thought they were putting her on. So they went. So she said, well, what do you suggest I say? So they went off and they huddled on that. And they came back and they said, well, so we've decided what you should say is, everything I own is rented. On the grounds that that at least wouldn't offend Hertz and Avis, I suppose, huh? Well, the point is, this is going on all the time. So that any issues that really affect the basic issues of our society, which is the control of America by the very largest corporations, are not going to be discussed. On radio and TV, the prime means of communication in America, okay? The second problem is the institutional control of the process. There's either is or will soon be in the Center magazine out of Santa Barbara a piece about Super News. Many of us still have the notion of journalism as that of the reporter with a pad out there, you know, finding out what's going on and asking tough questions and coming back and writing the story. The fact is that this stuff is manufactured in news manufacturing plants the same way that the entertainment programs come out of those television manufacturing factories in out in Hollywood. When you have any idea of the numbers of people involved in this, the millions of dollars, the studio facilities, the TV advisors and public relations people who are around, the armies of them, who are controlling what's going to be news today and tomorrow and what you're going to get, what's fed to the wire services, the extent to which journalism becomes repeating rather than reporting, just simply passing on what, you know, yesterday's top official had to say about this or so. You know, that's a major part of the problem. And then finally, you've got a president who's really, you know, set out to see if
if you can do it in America in 1973 the way they did it in Germany in 1933, and has decided that he's got to innovate a little bit, but basically is headed the same place. Never before in this century, in my judgment, have we been confronted with the kind of threat to suppression of the most American of our basic presumptions, which is freedom of speech and the First Amendment. This is a very dangerous age in which we are living. And by and large, the American people have not been told about what's going on in terms of media control by this administration. And what I would challenge you to do is at least see to it that your students address these issues. Talk about how does what get on the media? How do you watch television intelligently, if indeed that is possible? You know, I've said if you want to watch television, you know, go ahead and do it, because I sort of people ought to do what they want to do. But if you want to watch TV, you know, take it as a clue that there's something wrong with the way you're living. That's what Test Pattern for Living is about. See, that's the latest book. I won't give you that speech because we're already running out of time if we're going to have any questions. But you've got a president now who's bringing the sophistication that Joe McGinnis described in the selling of the president in 1968, what they did with that campaign. And if you go back as speech teachers, it's very interesting. I reread Six Crises this last summer. And I'd never known before, but you know, when I think of crises in my life, I don't think in terms of speeches exactly. I mean, I think of the time at the, you know, trailer almost whipped the car off the road, or the horse fell down and my kid's leg got broken, we didn't know how we'd get him back, and stuff like that. I mean, those are my crises, you know. But all of Nixon's crises have to do with speeches. Did you realize that? The first thing was the Hiss hearing. It turns out to have been the first televised congressional hearing. And then his trip to Russia, and he was going to make one of the first television appearances of an American official before the Russian people. And you just go right through that book, the Checkers speech. And he prepares for battle before he makes the speech. And he goes through long, sleepless periods because he works best when he's really totally exhausted. And I mean, it's a really fantastic book. You really ought to go back and read it. But you'll never appreciate, you know, the problem that you have and the challenge you have working with these young students of yours until you realize how much of a crisis a speech can be. So then we saw the selling of the president in 1968. Although we didn't see it on Broadway except for one night. I was very sorry about that. I thought that was a great show. It still is a great show. But it wasn't very well received here. In any event, it was a good book. And if you missed the show, which you probably did, if you hadn't, it would have still been there. You could... I feel badly about it because I was a technical advisor. I didn't advise them on how to make money. But we did have a good time. In any event, you probably read the book. And then after the selling of the president in 1968, then this guy moves the same paraphernalia right on into the White House. His first appointments were three former advertising agency executives and a lobbyist for Procter & Gamble. I mean, that's this man's perspective on what the presidency is about. And it has been that ever since. He creates an Office of Communications, making this the only nation outside of the communist and fascist world to have a director of communications, whose job it is to contact radio and television stations, find out what they're putting on about the president, praise them when they say nice things, criticize them when they say bad things, send out leaflets, book cabinet officers on shows, get Martha Mitchell on Laugh-In and Agnew on The Tonight Show. That's his job. And he does it very effectively. And if you've got a large staff to do it, you can do that very effectively, particularly if you happen to be the president of the United States. He's got an Office of Telecommunications Policy, besides. And this is the way the whole presidency is perceived. It's a gigantic television production, performance, perspective on what it's about. The greatest achievement of the first term was the TV show he did from China. I mean, that's the way it's perceived within the administration. Well, in any event, we mustn't dwell on that. After all, he's the only president we've got, right? But did you see this new committee that he's got formed now to figure out how he can run again in 76? I mean, it may turn out to be he's not only the only president we've got, but the only president we'll ever have. They're working on that. They're working on that. Well, I just, I think you all ought to do something about this. Because I'm leaving. Somebody's got to do something about this. I am leaving June 30th. And so I leave it to you to do something about it. I think these issues ought to be talked about more in your classrooms. I would encourage you to take on a project in your local community. Figure out the standards by which you want to evaluate the performance of stations there. Numbers of commercials, percentage of news, quantity of public affairs programming, amount of children's programming, things of that sort, whatever criteria you want, and sit down and just rank them and compare them and come up with some kind of objective evaluation of the performance of the stations in your community. Then have the students pay a call on the local general manager, confront him with these facts, see what he says. You know, why is it that this particular radio station chooses to have no news and no public affairs whatsoever? Why is it that this particular ABC outlet chooses not to run Issues and Answers but to run another old movie instead? Why is it that that this particular local television station carries nothing for children between the hours of 3 and 6 in the afternoon? Confront them with some of these questions, particularly if you can show that other people in the same community are doing it, or other, comparably fixed stations in the United States with similar incomes and responsibilities are able to do it elsewhere. And if you get some results, fine, and if you don't, you can participate in the next round at the license renewal time, or file a fairness doctrine complaint or something, see what that's about. Work it into an interdisciplinary team teaching effort. Involve some people from political science or law school or whatever, and get them involved in this if you want. I think that is something you can do. You want to know what can you do, that is something you can do. So, that's what I leave you with, and then we take questions. Is that right?
Right.
Okay, we're open for questions. Yes.
Like, how much control does the White House have over the Federal Communications Commission now through Clay Whitehead?
The question is, how much control does the White House have over the FCC? Another question might be, how much control does the White House need over the FCC? The president appoints the commissioners, and they are not notoriously known as desiring to confront him with policies that he would not appreciate. Putting that aside for the moment, so that he's picking the people, the lawyers are all cleared for political clearance before they can be taken on board. The top staff people have to be cleared with the White House before they can be brought on board. Not just the Office of Telecommunications Policy, but the Civil Service Commission, the Office of Management and Budget, all these people are swarming over us all the time. So there's plenty of opportunity for input from any number of directions. Specifically with regard to the Office of Telecommunications Policy, the principal advantage that Whitehead has over the rest of us is that he's got all the capacity to do analysis of national communications policy. I mean, the FCC flips about like a sailboat in a changing wind. It's we don't even have anybody really who can read, what he does. We once had a computer inquiry. The FCC found out about computers in about the late 60s sometime. and it occurred to somebody that it had something to do with communications, because they were having trouble getting their little information bits down that little 2-bit wire of the Bell system. And the question was, what can we do about it? Well, we set up an inquiry, and we got a lot of really pretty first-class stuff that was sent to us. Millions of dollars went into this research and preparing these briefs and whatnot that were filed with us. And it came in, and they just sat around. And finally, somebody inquired, whatever happened to the computer inquiry? And he said, well, we got all this stuff. Well, what'd you do with it? Well, it's still there. Well, why? Well, we don't have anybody who can understand it. So we contracted with a subcontractor, Stanford Research Institute, and paid them, I don't know how many $100,000, to read the filings and then come and tell us in short sentences what, you know, what had been said to us. I mean, you know, that, I mean, you just don't have any sense of the order of magnitude of disparity between what the FCC is capable of doing and what somebody like AT&T or the Defense Department or anybody who's adequately staffed is capable of doing with these issues. So Whitehead comes along. He's got 60 or 70 professional economists over there. The FCC has one. And he lays some proposal on us for how domestic satellites ought to fly, and it sounds pretty convincing. So there's that level of influence, too. Another level of influence from OTP is like on a cable television policy, which up to the final point was one of the best things the FCC has done in terms of process. I mean, we had panel discussions before us where we literally heard from virtually every conceivable interest in the country. I mean, producers and minority groups and, you know, not just broadcasters and cable owners. Then we had hearings on top of that, and then we came up with a policy that we evolved out of working amongst ourselves, and we all participated in it. We followed the Administrative Procedure Act. We'd done all this, and then we read in the trade press that the chairman has gone over to the White House and sat down with Whitehead and the wealthiest businessmen in the affected industries, and they have personally written their own policy, which they like better than the FCC's, which Birch then brought back to us and said, here, swallow. And six swallowed. So that's another way in which the White House, can have influence. The president held his now famous, then secret, dinner with the wealthiest broadcasters, not the networks, but the stations, in their effort to divide the stations off from the networks. Dinner at the White House or Blair House, wherever it was, and just asked him, you know, what all they wanted, and agreed that he would try to provide them license renewal protection, and that he would veto the funds for the public broadcasting corporation since they were concerned about its providing them competition, and so forth, right on down the line. Well, he can do that kind of thing over there at night, and since that kind of stuff is generally done at night, I guess, and a lot of things go on to be hard to do in the sunshine. And that, needless to say, has an impact on what kind of power that leaves the FCC with.
Mr. Johnson, could you tell me how to account for the Brad Humbugs and the Oral Roberts buying time to sell and ask for prayerful contributions when those businessmen couldn't buy time for anti-war? When here in New York, WOR has three stations on Sunday asking for money for an idea, and these businessmen can't have an anti-war, has the FCC done anything about that?
Yes, it's supported the station in that case. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, you've really made your point. I don't know if there's anything that I can add to it. One of the more amusing hypocrisies and contrasts in station policies involved a sports department at ABC. During the Buffalo Holy Cross game, some students wanted to have a halftime ceremony in which they were going to sing "This Land Is Your Land" or some, you know, really radical song like that. And ABC Sports just swung those old cameras around and focused them on the cars going by in the street. And when asked why, they said, well, that's really too controversial because they were going to say something about peace. Then, you know, a number of weeks later, the Army-Navy game, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff comes out on the field to give us all a little pep talk on behalf of war, and ABC Sports finds that's not too controversial, and they go ahead and cover that. So we've got a number of, you know, hypocrisies in this business besides the ones that you've mentioned up front. Yes?
Where's CPB and PBS at, in your opinion, now, and where's it going to be?
Where's CPB and PBS and, you know, the public broadcasting and all that stuff, all those letters? Well, originally, the public broadcasting system was set up as a buffer within the Corporation for Public Broadcasting between the politically controlled corporation and the local stations for purposes of providing that kind of buffer, in the way that any good network executive will provide a buffer between advertisers trying to put pressure on his newsmen and the newsmen, who, if he's really doing his job, won't ever even pass those messages along to the newsmen. So when you set out to abolish PBS, it's kind of obvious what you got in mind. And at a time when those concerned about political control of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting were saying that it might sometime become a domestic voice of America, you know, who but Nixon would have the unerring instinct for the gross to select as his president of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a former director, voice of America? And now, recently, they've decided not to have any public affairs programming anymore on the grounds that, you know, a little information is a dangerous thing. A few people were sneaking over from the commercial networks and finding out things on public broadcasting, and we're going to put a stop to that. So I don't know. You know, I think it's pretty clear what they're up to. That's part of the overall pattern of media intimidation, control, elimination of anything that is taken by them to be critical of what it is they're setting about to do. Yes?
Are you familiar with the Sunshine Law in Georgia, and do you know whether it's working or how it's working?
The Sunshine Law?
Yeah.
I didn't know they made laws about it. What did they? I am all for sunshine. I know a song about Georgia sunshine, as a matter of fact. Oh, how I miss that Georgia sunshine. It's not
filming,
a bad song. What's the law?
Filming legislative sessions and supposedly airing them on public service broadcasting every night.
Oh, I see.
And
for that.
Yeah, it's new, I guess, and I was wondering if you'd had any feedback on it, whether people are watching it or whether it's making any difference in what the legislators or how they act. Or.
Well, the presumption always is that is that why they use sunshine, putting some light on those? Is that the theory? Oh, that's very colorful, isn't it?
I don't know.
Well, the presumption is that if you let people know what they're up to, that they'd stop doing it. And there's something to be said for that. And you know, you can use entertainment formats as well as public affairs formats for this. The Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In was at one point the heaviest public affairs programming being provided by any of the networks because they had this Flying Fickle Finger of Fate Award, as you may recall. Which was the most serious commentary ever to be heard between 7:30 and 10 or 11 p.m. On weekday evenings. Because, like they would, speaking of legislatures, they once awarded it to the California legislature for passing a law that permitted used car dealers to turn back speedometers. And they got the Flying Fickle Finger of Fate Award for that. And 30 days later, they repealed the law. And they presented it to a school board in Ohio that had appropriated no funds whatsoever for schools the next year. And the next week, they appropriated funds for the schools. So, yeah, I mean, that's basically what information is all about. The least hypocrisy in the whole equation was represented by a fellow who I was told about by a friend of mine, a black disc jockey, and the first job he had down south. He walked into the station, and the station manager handed him this big stack of records. And he said, "Here, boy, play these." And my friend said, "Well, you know, can I have some little news program on that, you know, an hour, half hour, something like that?" He says, "Well, we don't have any news wire here." And he said, "Well," he says, "I just, you know, maybe get the paper or something like that and find out." Because that's what they do, you know, a lot of them. They just read the newspaper over there. And he said, "No, we don't get the paper either." He said, "Well," I said, "you know, I subscribe to magazines and stuff like that. I can just talk to folks, find out what's going on." He says, "Look, boy," he says, "you're not going to educate the niggers of this community at my expense." Now, the thing I admire about that man is he's so upfront. I mean, no hypocrisy, no double talk about, "Well, our affiliates didn't want us to carry Sticks and Bones," see? I mean, none of that stuff. It's just, by God, we're not going to give them any information. We want to keep them ignorant. Because, you see, power shifts with information. Ignorance is power. Information is power. And that's the only power these days really worth fooling around with very much. When you have a revolution in South America, how do you know who won? It's who sees the radio stations and who's broadcasting now. When the Russians moved into Czechoslovakia, what was the first thing they went after? The radio and TV stations. They kept hiding from them, moving around underground, stuff like that. They finally got them. And what's Nixon doing? He's going after the radio and TV stations. That is power today. More than stocks and bonds, marching armies, land, industrial plant. Power is control of that little screen. Power is measured in your ability to keep information off of that screen. Power is measured in your ability to control the packaging of the information that does get on that little screen. And that struggle over power is what you are now watching. I told a story to the Violence Commission, the Eisenhower Commission, after the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Senator Kennedy. And the networks were saying the very existence of the Violence Commission constituted an interference in their proper corporate affairs. And so I said, look, you get that kind of talk from them, you tell them this story. And I told them about a friend of mine, a doctor in West Virginia, who'd done a piece on black lung. Now, black lung disease, for those of you who don't know about it, is a disease you get if you go into coal mines, you breathe coal dust, and the coal dust gets in your lungs, and it disintegrates your lungs, and they can't hold oxygen, and you become very weak by the time you're in your 40s, and you don't work anymore. And there's no workman's compensation benefits or anything for you. And since there's not, it doesn't cost the coal companies anything to do it this way. And to give you fresh air would cost them 70 cents a day. And therefore, obviously, they opt in favor of the lower cost option, which is to destroy human bodies in the manufacturing process, which is the option that most industries choose until it becomes more expensive to consume arms and legs and eyes than it becomes to put up guardrails and give people goggles and, in this case, fresh air masks. Any event, he did this... this piece, done by a doctor, it was not radical social commentary, it was just a nicely done program on black lung and what it is and does and so forth. There was not a single station in that state that would carry that program. And when a station out of state did carry it, a cable television system within the state, obliged by our regulations to carry it, just cut the station off the air during the time that show was on. All right, I just told this story to the Violence Commission. I said, when these guys start talking to you about governmental censorship, you tell them a little bit about corporate censorship, will you? Well, about 2 weeks after that, NBC scurried themselves down there and started doing some coverage on a black lung problem they had just discovered to be of great interest to them. It went down to NBC Wire. The stations, which by and large come in the morning and plug in and come around in the afternoon and pick up the money, just let it go on out over the air. The housewife sitting at home suddenly found out about this thing called black lung, and her husband came home and said, hey, honey, I finally found out why you're so tired. And pretty soon, the coal miners had found out about black lung disease. And about a month after that, 35,000 of them came out of the mines for the first time in the history of that state without any organizing effort, and they marched on the state capital of West Virginia, and they got them the first black lung legislation, a workman's compensation legislation in the history of that state. Now, that little anecdote illustrates, in the way that I could do with dozens more, but I think that'll make the point. Keeping that information off television, keeping Beverly Hillbillies and Gomer Pyle and so forth on television, serves the economic interests of a certain group of people. And putting on information about, you know, whatever, nutrition, the quantity of sugar that many of the breakfast cereals your kids are eating are almost 50% sugar, that the red dye, red 2, that has been banned in virtually every country in the world except for the United States, causes fetal death with as little as the amount contained in two bottles of cherry soda for a woman of 110 pounds, and yet has not been banned by the Food and Drug Administration because in spite of its own staff reports, because it's Red 2 is used in some $35 billion worth of products a year that you are consuming today. You know, I could go on and on and on with these things. They're widely known in Washington among the public interest research groups, but you are not being told about them on the local news sponsored by your local supermarket. And there is an economic loss to you as well as a loss of life and health and mental health and a lot of other things that comes as a result of keeping that information off. And that's what this power struggle is about. And I think that's something your students ought to know about. Because, you know, we are literally living in an age when what we don't know can kill us.